Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are Brigadier General Ty Setchell and pollster and strategist Jim Gerstein. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now, I'm going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please check out the links to our sponsors, Lomi, ZBiotics, and Miracle Made, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, James, with a war in the Middle East, prospects for a protracted Ukraine war, and worries about China, it's a time when Washington, you know, needs to have its act together. It's not even close. It doesn't. The House, no matter who Republicans try to select as the next speaker, the result's going to be chaos for the next year, with the ever-present threat of a significant number of far-right MAGA extremists who really are nihilists. And if Republicans can't legislate, they then turn to investigations, even impeachments, and they end up making fools of themselves. The Senate only looks good compared to the House. President Biden gave an excellent speech on the Israel-Hamas tragedy, but people, Democrats, are still talking about his age. So, James, give me some good news.
Well, first of all, I think the president's remarks were pretty spot on yesterday. There's not a lot of good news. I mean, I could say there's some continues to be good news in the labor market. That's pretty true. But internationally, and, you know, you're right, you got Ukraine, now this, now China, you know, think about Korea, you know, other problems that spring up. But I know they talk about the president's age, but he doesn't get any younger.
That's the fact we discovered, isn't it, James?
It's been the problem, but it is, and it's been a problem since it started. Is not going to go away. And I know that, you know, probably everything is going to, but I think politically is going to happen, is I think they're going to be like a standstill for the next week or 10 days. I mean, they're crazy ass people to say anything. And they're not our crazy ass people. These left wing crazy ass people will say anything. But usually these things historically help a president's approval rating. So let's see if this happens here in the next 10 to 14 days.
Yeah, I think they actually they don't do as much as they used to. And this is,
certainly
made a full-throated support of Israel. I think it, to some extent, is going to depend how it all ensues, and we have some good guests to talk about that later. But you're right, that's a potential bright spot. How about, there's still Democrats, you know, who are talking about getting in this race. They're not top line Democrats, but Dean Phillips of Minnesota is talking about getting in New Hampshire. RFK Jr. dropped out of the race after making a fool of himself, so he'll make a fool of himself now as an independent candidate. And the filing deadlines are really coming up by the end of this month. So it doesn't look like any heavyweight's going to get in, but, you know, maybe Dean Phillips will be the alternative or someone like that.
I don't know. And right now it looks like we're steaming toward a Trump-Biden general election, which 70% of the people in the country don't want. And I just think that this is not a good idea. But the
Well, you're right. We also need to keep in mind that the Republicans have their own set of problems, which in some way are greater. And I admit, I do not understand why Trump continues to get the numbers he gets. Of course, I didn't understand.
Because their voters are crazy. It's a hard, that's the thing you got to, until you process that. You ever talk about Nancy Mace? She changed because she went back home and found out she wasn't going to get elected to anything.
Voters are crazy. I don't think the number's that high. I think you're right. 30% are crazy. Yeah.
Well, if you voting for Trump, if you're on a poll and everything that you know, and you're still voting for Trump, you're fucking crazy.
Okay. I may have
if
to
you know all about the criminality, you know all about the national security breaches, all about the rudeness, all about, I even get into the personal stuff. I mean, and you still, complicit in storming the Capitol, or calling for the assassination of
a convicted rapist,
four-star general. I mean, yeah, a convicted rapist. I'm sorry. And you're still for this guy? But something's wrong with you.
Well, let's hope they get some therapy in the next 12 months.
Well, I mean, and all this third-party stuff is, you know, they're brewing out there.
Okay, next week, or maybe 2 weeks from now, or sometime, we're going to come back with better news, I promise, out there. Jim Gerstein is not only one of America's great pollsters, he has deep roots in Israel. He's a graduate of Tel Aviv University. He's done some important polling over there. Jim, I know you have friends and associates there. First, I want to ask, are they safe? And what are you hearing in the aftermath of this horrendous terrorist act?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking, Al. My family, my friends are all safe and accounted for, but they're very shaken. So they're very shaken, and they are, I'd say they have a kind of a cocktail of emotions of based on what's been going on. And it's a tough situation, but, you know, our thoughts are with them and our support is with them.
You're absolutely right. I turned off the television twice. I mean, I just couldn't watch it. I don't think I've ever done that before. It was just so terrible. Look, the focus is on the war. And usually when there is a perilous security crisis, it tends to help politically the hardliner, in this case, Netanyahu. On the other hand, there was a massive intelligence and military failure that occurred on his watch. Now, we know a lot's going to intervene and be joined politically, but what do your superb instincts tell you about how this is going to play out?
I mean, we're talking on Wednesday, and it's a very fluid situation. So I think you're right. Things are going to move in a lot of different directions. Both in terms of the military response, in terms of the internal political dynamics. But what I would say that is striking about this particular situation is that typically you see a rally around the leader effect constantly. And there is a ton of solidarity in the country. 360,000 reservists have been called to duty, and they are reporting with energy, with enthusiasm, with eagerness to help restore safety and security to the country. And many of these reservists were just 2 weeks ago or less than 2 weeks ago out on the streets protesting the judicial overhaul. So this, that people have put things aside to advance the security situation in the country. I am struck, though, by the amount of criticism of Netanyahu so quickly into this situation. When I said it at the beginning, there's a cocktail of emotions. People are, they are just in horror by the atrocities that they've seen, about the people that they know who have been killed, the situation with the hostages. But they're also really angry at their government and at their military for the security lapse.
Would you?
And
I was going to say. Go ahead. Please go ahead.
I was just going to say, I've not seen such criticism of the prime minister so quickly into a situation like this. And whether it's editorials in newspapers, columnists, or intelligence analyses.
Well, Jim, didn't the intelligence and security leaders warn that Netanyahu's determination and total focus on remaking the Israel legal system, which caused such a massive uproar, which you just described, that was a distraction that made the country more vulnerable?
This did happen. It was widely reported at the time prior to the attack. I think, you know, like I said at the beginning, right now, the country's focus is on fighting this war. There is going to be an inquiry or, you know, an investigation down the road to look at what led to all of this. And, you know, I think Netanyahu was pretty weak going in prior to the attacks. And I think that that inquiry is going to a lot of people will be held responsible, but certainly the person at the top of the pyramid.
Jim, I hate to bring this up, but it's almost certain there's going to be an incursion in Gaza. That's going to really be god awful. I mean, it's totally justified, but it really is. I mean, Tom Friedman wrote this morning, just think twice, you know, before you do it. You got to retaliate, but boy, that's going to be rough, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought his piece was very, very insightful, very thought provoking, and very important. I think the situation for facing Israel right now is they don't have good options. There really is. They've got a series of hard decisions to make. They finally have some professionals in the decision making process. The Benny Gantz just joined a war cabinet. There's going to be a 3-person war cabinet, or a 3-person decision making war cabinet, and now they have Benny Gantz in there, who was the former defense minister and part of the political opposition, and former chief of staff of the military. So I think that will give some confidence to the public about who's involved in some of the decision making. But these are incredibly difficult decisions that the leadership needs to make, and none of them have good options. As you mentioned, the ground incursion. This is urban warfare in a very densely populated area, and there have been ground incursions or ground troops there before, and we still had this situation that we have today. What's different now is we have approximately 150 hostages there, and that makes this incredibly difficult to navigate, and it's I hate to repeat myself, but there are not good options here, but there's a lot of important work to be done.
James?
So, Jim, let's talk about the government as currently structured, because there's been a declaration of war and there's been an announcement of a unity government. Who's going to make decisions and how are people going to be held accountable? And does this suspend the holding of elections? Just politically, how does this change everything?
Okay, so as of a couple of hours ago, they established a war cabinet. And okay. Within that war cabinet, as I understand it at this moment, and this is subject to change.
Oh, gotcha.
But there are 3 decision makers. Right. Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, and Benny Gantz, who I just mentioned, who is a former defense minister, former chief of staff of the military, and is the head of one of the parties in the opposition. So it's not exactly a unity government. It is a war cabinet that includes people, includes members of the coalition of the opposition who are now entering. In addition to that, those 3 people as the formal decision makers, there are advisors to this war cabinet, one of whom comes from Benny Gantz's party, his name is Gadi Eisenkot, who was one of the, he's also a former chief of staff of the military. So there are some professionals now entering this decision making, and the head of the opposition, the leader of the party, the largest party in the opposition, is Yair Lapid. He has not joined the government as of now. He is one, his condition is that Netanyahu discard the two most extreme and radical elements of the coalition, so that there's not that, you know, that you don't have them involved in a war like situation. The last thing I'd say is, in terms of UCS about holding elections, things like that, there is no date. There is no date on the calendar. There's clearly, obviously, not going to be an election during this war. Right. That would be way too disruptive for prosecuting it, certainly in these stages of the war. The one really important political piece that just happened is when Gantz joined, Netanyahu agreed to stop all other legislation, and that relates to the judicial overhaul.
So everything's on the back burner.
Everything's on hold. They're at war.
So this is something, there's going to be an inquiry. There's going to be, and one thing that we know about Israel is there's a lot of finger pointing going to go on here, and there's a lot of other stuff that's going to happen. It's something that you and I have never been fans of. And when it started, people said this is going to bite us on the ass one day at these settlements. And how much do you think that settlement policy worked toward provoking this kind of thing that we just saw? Make it worse for the country?
I think it's a very important question, James. I want to qualify everything I say with, in light of some folks arguing that this, Israel had this coming, all this.
No one has. That's bullshit.
Exactly. These attacks are unprovoked on civilians, and you can't, there's no justification at all. Okay. So obviously, yes. The settlements have historically and continue to be a source of major tension, major provocation for the tensions between Israel and the Palestinians. They undermine the efforts to have a two-state solution. We are now seeing how the when you bring into the government settler leaders, how the resources get even further diverted to the settlements, both financial resources and now the military resources. And we're talking about settlements in the West Bank. There are no settlements in Gaza.
Yes. A very important distinction to make. But the settlements kept growing, and they were a political force. I mean, they were like a group that organized and just stayed on it and pushed and pushed. And as I understand it, some of them were pretty aggressive toward the non-settlers that were in the same area. I mean, it was a lot of back and forth.
There, just in the last year, there have been attacks on Palestinian residents of the West Bank by settlers, Jewish settlers in the West Bank. And that, of course, escalates the situation, diverts resources back to that conflict. Not at all justifying in any way, shape, or form what has happened.
It's very clear to make that point. It doesn't murdering children is as unjustifiable as anything can be. Mm-hmm. And, you can be I think that this is just a seminal moment for Israel because it's always reminded, if it ever forgets, that it's living in a hostile neighborhood.
Yeah, a lot of the analysis has been that the government took its eye off the ball in Gaza because their attention was on the settlements in the West Bank.
Well, that's what the Egyptians are putting out, and I don't know who I believe.
Go ahead.
And the U.S. and the Israelis both throw cold water on the fact that the Iranians were involved. Do you know anything or have any feelings about this?
Like, I think the people who are driving the narrative that the Iranians are responsible and that Biden is the cause of all this, that it's the Republican Party. It's just nonsense. And so, obviously, I think the White House has put out very clear information on the Iranian role, and that, you know, it's obviously complicit more broadly due to its longtime support and interest in parties like Gaza, like Hamas and Hezbollah. But that there's no direct evidence at this point in time that they orchestrated this specific atrocity. And I think the distraction campaign by, you know, you just turn on Fox News and that's all they're talking about.
Well, for one observation to make, turn back to you, that operation was very sophisticated. I mean, this was not a bunch of rubes, you know, casing out the bank or something like that. I mean, they came in on paragliders. They had moved earth moving equipment to the border. You don't think the satellites could have said, hey, man, what's going on here? In addition to the maneuvers and everything else. But I got to believe, man, I've obviously been to Gaza and seen it. I got to believe they had help. And that's, I mean, whoever the military planner did this, or planners, knew what they were doing.
And they kept it quiet.
Yeah.
I mean, think about how, I mean, this, you're right, this was very sophisticated operation, an evil in all aspects of it, and pulled off with a evil execution. And they, but the fact that they were able to keep it quiet for so long, obviously there were a lot of signals that were missed, and that this has really hurt the Israeli psyche that something like this could happen. And that plays into all of the next steps and the damage to their psyche and what they're going, how they're going to respond. I would add to this, going back to what Al asked about ground troops, they are clearly prepared for, when they plan this, they are clearly planning for the next day and know, they know what Israel's potential responses are. And they will not be surprised and unprepared for a ground attack. And so I think that's one of the things that the military experts are in Israel are certainly trying to figure out and navigate. And how do you go in there without having your soldiers being sitting ducks, which is very scary, because these are reservists in many. I mean, these are young people. But they're also reservists. They're parents. They are. I have friends who are in their 50s and 60s who are running to the border as reservists. I mean, this is. There are a lot of people. Everyone in Israel is affected by what the next decisions are made.
Jim, I was a young reporter in Washington in 1973, the Yom Kippur War. Israel was caught off guard again, and then they rallied and massively defeated, score a huge victory. But boy, it changed Israeli politics, didn't it? I mean, it started to mark the end of the labor reign. And within, 3 years, Likud took over. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine something like this not having a huge impact in domestic politics, whatever it is.
Right. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head when you say it took 3 years. That's when the next election took place. And it was then that next election was the first time in the history of the country that the Labor Party did not win. And that's what brought in Menachem Begin to be the new prime minister, whom, by the way, then made peace with Egypt, one of the countries that attacked them in the Yom Kippur War. And that had a long-lasting stabilizing effect for Israel and the region.
Let me ask you about part of Netanyahu's coalition are the right-wing religious fundamentalists. They don't fight in these wars as a general rule, do they? I mean, you talked about all the reservists who were called up, and both young kids and 50 and 60 year olds are going. There's AWOL. Is that going to affect them politically at all? Because they have been a powerful political force.
Yes, the ultra religious in the country do not serve in the army. There have been ongoing efforts by the center-left to require them and pass legislation that requires a form of national service or some sort of contribution to the country. And it has been repeatedly blocked by the right, who has been in power. And it's one of the big priorities and things that a ultra-religious party demands when it goes into a coalition. The big ones are not requiring them to serve in the military and funding the religious schools. And so you're right. There is a lot of tension over this issue in the country, a lot of division. This actually speaks to the judicial overhaul scenario as well, because that overhaul was being pushed by, among others, the religious, ultra-religious parties, so that the Supreme Court could not strike down laws that would be seen as violating the rights of the majority secular population. So, again, I do come back to right now the country is unified and in solidarity in a war effort, but that these divisions are very deep, very enduring, and will certainly play out as time goes
on. Jim, I've only been to Israel 3 or 4 times, but I have an enormous admiration for the country, its citizens, its ingenuity, its courage, but that's a really screwed up political system.
I agree on every one of your points.
Okay.
Wonderful people, wonderful country, an important place in the world for the Jewish people, but a completely dysfunctional political system that rivals the House Republican Caucus in terms of its functional.
That's a function. Good comparison. That's a really great analogy, James.
So Jim, I've worked in Israel, Ukraine, and Afghanistan. I think I need to turn my passport in. not a very impressive trail.
Head to Switzerland, James.
let's turn to American domestic politics. And by all accounts, the president's words were very appropriate yesterday, to the point. You do a lot of poll in America. Do you expect any kind of a mild bump from this, or we don't know? What's your general view?
But before I answer that directly, I want to also, because I forgot to mention at the outset, I got bombarded with messages yesterday and today from people in Israel about how much they loved and appreciated Biden's speech.
That's why I brought them in a text here.
They are, if the media is effusive in its praise of him. I think what's happened is they just went through this awful experience and felt devastated. And to see the president of the United States come out in such a heartfelt and powerful support for the country was kind of the morale boost that they needed at the moment. And so I think that that's an important piece of the overall dynamic in Israel. Here at home, before talking about the general population, I just side note, Jews in America are among Biden's biggest supporters and I think are overwhelmingly pleased with his statements and what he's done. Will this, will this have any impact on the U.S. political, in the election and all that? I mean, maybe he'll get a bump because he's seen as, this speaks to his leadership skills, his experience in foreign policy, national security, some of the adult in the room piece to what people were looking for when they voted for him. But this is not what the 2024 election is going to be about. And, hopefully this does send a message to voters of reassurance and reminder of what they like about him. But it's not what the election is about. And the election is going to turn on things like the economy and abortion rights.
Right. I think it's not a provable thing, but I think the public just senses disorder everywhere. If it's the southern border, if it's crime, if it's in the House of Representatives, if it's the Middle East, if it's gas prices. And of course, Biden didn't have anything to do with what happened in Israel, but obviously, he obviously doesn't have anything to do with the fact that the Republicans can't elect a speaker. But what scares me strategically is this sense that things are just getting away from us.
Mm-hmm. I think that point is right on target and speaks to one of the underlying dynamics in the country. I would add homelessness to
homelessness
that list of things
for
that
sure,
are
that was just a stupid omission of mine. It's a huge, huge issue. And people, they're not against homeless people. They just don't want them in their neighborhoods. They don't mind immigrants. All right. They just don't want them flooding in across the border. But I just think that the problem that President Biden has is the country is in this mood that no one's in charge here. That's all. But I, my best to you. I know your family, you got in-laws over there. I know how much you passionately care about the country and what happens. This is going to be a long haul, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, no good options. It's going to be long. Just kind of hope that we get past this and try to find some, some long-term solutions.
Before I let you go now, you can get more, cause of course, how worried are people about Hezbollah causing mischief on the northern border?
Very worried. It's a key piece to this to have to fight on two fronts that stretches your resources even further. One of the friends I mentioned has been called up for the reserves is on the northern border right now. It's not, there are incursions, there are rockets, there's people in bomb shelters, and it's trying. And Tom Friedman, I think, wrote about this and spoke about it a lot. Further destabilization can unravel quickly and bring in, see what that does to U.S. involvement if this goes more regional. And as Hezbollah gets, if that front opens up, you do have an Iranian element.
Yeah, you sure do.
Added to this equation, which is very scary.
Jim, I agree. This is a, it's a tragedy. It's very sad. You have to feel just terrible right now, but I know over the long run, a country with its history, a country with the richness of its, as they say, its courage and its talent, it's going to be okay. It's just the hell that they may have to go through to get there.
Yeah,
you are a terrific guest, and we've learned a lot. Thank you so much.
Thank you, man.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey, James, our guest is Army General Ty Sedgley, 36 years of service in the Army, hot spots all over the world. He's a professor emeritus of history at West Point and an acclaimed author. General, let me talk about Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville. He's put holds on around 300 military promotions to try to get the Pentagon to change its policies on abortions. The Alabama freshman says, hey, it may be a minor personal inconvenience, but it doesn't really hurt our military readiness, does it?
The baloney. I will tell you right now that the senator from Alabama's policy is both stupid and evil. It's stupid because those he is hurting and those he's doing, which is the senior leaders of the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Space Force, have no ability to change the policy. So they are innocent in this. In fact, one of the great things about the United States military is we are apolitical. One of the only militaries in the history of the world that has never had a military coup d'etat. And part of that is that it's because of our senior leaders going back to Washington. And yet he is hurting them. It is hurting our readiness, which I can go into The eaches on this is hurting families, which I can go into on the eaches on this. It's hurting our readiness. It's hurting our allies. It's hurting our fight against Ukraine. It's hurting our fight, our support in Israel. And it's going to hurt how we're fighting in China. It's hurting our cyber force. I mean, it is hurting the entire thing, and it is going to take years to recover. So no, he is absolutely wrong. And he is hurting great Americans who are serving their country. I couldn't be more upset about this policy, about making the military generals and admirals political pawns for him.
Well, let's just take a current example right now. Pentagon has just dispatched the USS Gerald Ford, our most advanced carrier, along with other ships, to the Middle East as a signal of support for Israel. The head of naval operations and the head of the Fifth Fleet are among those being held back by Tuberville. That makes it rather hard to command that presence over there, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And it's worse than that, because the staff on Central Command, many of the generals and admirals on the staff at Central Command, which is based out of Tampa, which is planning some of the actions around that, are also not in the positions. It's also hurting us in European Command, because European Command is the one that is in charge of Israel, and they have many places, people that aren't in the right positions. The senior military representative for NATO also can't take that position. So it is now, I think, over 300, 308, last time I checked, of people that are not in the correct positions. And think about the follow on, because it's not just it's hurting us in the Gerald Ford, because the Navy doesn't have it. The Fifth Fleet doesn't have it. Neither does the Seventh Fleet. I was just at the Naval Academy, and they don't have the superintendent there on board. So they had to put a temporary officer, Admiral Fasher, in charge of the Naval Academy. And he's supposed to take the Seventh Fleet, which is in charge of China, Korea, Japan. That's the largest fleet there. So, and then everyone back is backed up to support this too. So in fact, Admiral Franchetti says that, and this is a quote from her testimony, she's the one who's supposed to be the chief of naval operations, it will take years to recover from the promotions if confirmed because of these delays.
Well, that is just a terrible commentary on those patriot-waving senators who won't put a stop to this. I mean, damn it, there is absolutely no reason. I mean, don't talk to me about this bullshit about the world's greatest deliberative body. Stop Tuberville's damage right now, and they won't do it.
No, and I don't know how they can get to do it. I think that's things that you and James could talk about, is how do you get them to do it? But the effect of it, I think just one other part of this, which is, you know, I know that some of your listeners may be surprised at how much a general or admiral makes. So if you're a 4-star admiral, you make, not including benefits, $212,000 a year. Now, remember, Trump once said, hey, how much do you make, Millie? And he thought, is it $5 million a year? No, it's $212. So we have over 30 different people that can't retire, that are being forced to continue on active duty in jobs they have been in for years and years and years, because they're not allowed to do that. You can also talk about the colonels and captains who should be promoted to brigadier general or rear admiral. They're losing $2,600 a month, and I know that's not the biggest deal in the world, but these are people who are serving their nation when it makes most fiscal sense to get out at 20 and start that next career. They're not doing that, and for pilots, you know, we're keeping the pilots in. There is a huge lack of pilots in the force. And so that's another one that these people are sacrificing their fiscal well-being to continue to serve. And yet, Senator Tuberville will not take those holds off. That's not even including the children who are stuck in limbo and can't start the right schools in place, or the spouses who can't get new jobs in the places where they're going. So it's not just... it's America. That's why I say it's stupid and evil. It's stupid because it's hurting our readiness. It's evil because it's hurting the families and those who choose to serve this great nation.
Boy, you have really laid it out, James.
Well, Senator Tuberville, stupidity option is always a viable option. and if you were to explain to him and our audience how Central Command structure is to the military. I mean, maybe he looks at it and says, well, you got one guy there, he'll just stay there, another guy move around. I don't think he really understands the relationship between command structure and a functioning military.
James, it's a great point. So I've listened to his pod. He was on a podcast and recently and said, and he said, this is a quote that he said, listen, those generals and admirals, they're just not that important. You know, it's the corporals and the privates that are really the ones that count. And listen, those at the pointy end of the bayonet are incredibly important, but you've got to, this is from coming from a coach, you know, it's like saying, no, we have no need for coaches. Just send out 11 people on the field and it's going to turn out fine. But he also said, and this is a quote, I don't care if they promote anybody, to be honest with you. He has no idea. So listen, we are a hierarchical organization, or as I like to say, it's an obedience-based organization, which means that we follow the orders of those above us. And those above us have been, you know, it takes 18 years to create an Army battalion commander, 22 to be a brigade commander, 25 to be a division commander. You can't, that's why we don't take people off the street to be in these positions. You got to grow into them and take successive positions. And to get that experience, you have to rise up through the ranks. So when you get to be a 2, 3, and 4-star general commanding a division or an aircraft strike battle group, man, that's just an amazing level. I mean, thousands, tens of thousands of people that you're in charge of, and mistakes which happen in combat or in training all the time happen all the time. And if you are not experienced in that, you're going to make more of them. So I just heard somebody at the Naval Academy say that the last strike battle group rotation he went on, everybody came home. There were no accidents and nobody died. That is the exception. Because we're talking about inherently dangerous things. And if you don't have experienced leadership who know they're in that leadership, you can't do it. Moreover, you need to change that leadership out. It is such a demanding job. You can't stay in those jobs for years and years and years. It's too physically, emotionally, and mentally demanding. You have to rotate out to make sure that we have this system so you have the 3 and 4-star generals that are qualified. So the level of harm he is causing to the private and sergeants who are going to have less leadership or lack leadership. I might also say that what he's forcing people to do at that high level is have 2 and 3 jobs simultaneously. So right now we have no vice chief of staff of any, I don't know if any of these services, they're the ones that actually run the service. Sort of the chief is out, the vice chief is in. And is in other words, commanding inside the Pentagon and running the budget and everything else. Well, it means that the chief or the acting chief, depending on the case, is doing 2 jobs simultaneously. And these are enormous jobs. But because of Senator Tuberville, that we're having to double up dozens and dozens of jobs that otherwise need to be done only by one person. It is a level of here's what I think it is, James. I think it's dereliction of duty.
Well, if I'm Chinese general, admiral, I'm in Russia, take any country. And I'm saying, and I get briefed and I said, wait, now, let me tell you, one guy is holding up the whole command structure of the U.S. military. I don't think people could even grasp that could happen. It's so outrageous. You have to tell me about it again. I don't understand this. Yeah, there's one guy, he's pretty stupid, he's from Alabama, and he's paralyzed the entire command structure of the most powerful military in the world. At some point you say, is this country a joke?
It's crazy. And, you know, it goes back to the Constitution, and the Constitution says that the Senate must confirm all military commissions and promotions. And of course, this is because we want to ensure civilian control of the military, which happens really well. Remember that there are 50,000 promotions a year that the Senate confirms and has to do on a unanimous basis. Could you imagine doing all 50,000 individually? And so the Senate Armed Services Committee, which is, you know, the chair of that committee is Jack Reed, great American. Right. Roger Wicker is the ranking, also a great American. And by the way, you know, the Senate, the National Defense Authorization Bill went through the SASC, the Senate Armed Services Committee, unanimously. These things have gone, it would be unanimous if it wasn't for this one senator. So he is not stopping promotions commissions. He's not stopping the promotions to major lieutenant commander or commander lieutenant colonel or colonel. So it's not as though he's doing all of them. He's just doing to make sure he hurts the military as much as he possibly can.
So wait, back up. a promotion has to be confirmed unanimously by the Senate according to the Constitution?
It has to be confirmed. What the Constitution says is it has to be confirmed, advise and consent. It has to be confirmed by the Senate.
The Constitution doesn't say one senator can stop the whole thing.
It does not say. No way.
It's 99-1. In the Senate, 51-49 is as good as 100-0.
Right, but remember that if because of the way this crazy system in the Senate works in the hold, which has changed over time, this system means that it wants that he can hold this. It's a crazy system.
You're the expert here. Can't they just vote to just do away with it?
They could vote on a one-time basis. They could vote to change that rule tomorrow. And that's right. Why I think Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell, this is going on now, I think, General, for like 8 or 9 months. I mean,
8 months.
And I think obviously, I think everything that Tuberville's doing, it's evil, it's stupid, but he's stupid. But the Senate knows better, and I think it's a dereliction of their duty, James. And I don't know if the general agrees with me not to change that rule.
I don't get it. And the only thing I comment on, making go back to the general here, is these things, when the military does something, it's really long-range stuff. They just don't get up one day and decide we're going to send an aircraft carrier here or we're going to move a division of people there. I mean, the amount of planning and the sophistication and the command structure and the continuity, the more you think about it, I think, General, the worse it gets.
It is, and you know, you just start looking at it more and more. There are other issues. So, for instance, when I was stationed in NATO, I was FROC, which means I was a major at the time, but I had to be in a lieutenant colonel position because I was working with other nations, and they're really sensitive about what rank you are. So if you're an acting, like you should be in a 2-star slot, you're 1-star, you're a captain colonel, and you're in a 1-star slot, they're really sensitive about that. Here's another good example. NORTHCOM, United States Northern Command, is in charge of the continental U.S. and the defense of the U.S. and really sort of Canada as well, both from missiles and also from other ways when 9/11 happened, NORTHCOM was responsible for the response of that on U.S. soil. So right now, that person is supposed to retire soon. If the NORTHCOM person retires, which he is going to have to do, a Canadian will be in charge of that organization and the defense of the United States. So we just keep coming to second and third order effects as the longer this goes on. So by the end of this year, I mean, I got the numbers here just because it was so amazing to me to figure out how much it'll be. There's a total of 850 some general officers, 852. By the end of this year, 650 will need to pass through the Senate for promotion or reassignment. And so nearly 90% of the nation's general and flag officers will be affected by this hold from the senator from Alabama. I don't even know, like, to speak his name. It's like he who shall not be named from my perspective.
A couple questions, General. Let me on a different subject. Conservative critics like Ted Cruz have said that because of the emphasis on diversity and inclusion, the United States Army is too, and I quote Cruz, woke and has been emasculated. Is that true?
That is just such bull. Oh my God, that just ticks me off hearing about it. We have the finest military in the history of the world because we represent the finest country in the world. And the idea that we're the woke military is just, look where we are. We don't have time to do that. What we do have time though to do, and I think is really, really important that we think about is, we are the most diverse workforce in the country. Mm-hmm. We have the most diversity in the country. And starting in, can I give you a little history here?
Sure.
Do you mind if I give a little history?
You're an historian, so we want to get into
it. I can't help it. So in 1948, the Army the military was forced to integrate. It didn't want to. And it did it in fits and starts, didn't really want to. And so in 1969, the service members' kids are still going to segregated black schools. In 1969, Mississippi has one black National Guardsman, not 1%, one. In the 1960s, there are 0.2% Black officers in the Navy and the Marine Corps. And when you start to have a volunteer army in the early 70s, you can't do this anymore. You can't have a volunteer military and have a force that is nearly all led by white people. You just can't do it. And there's race riots in that early period. So what happens is white leaders, Elmo Zumwalt in the Navy, Melvin Layer, Secretary of Defense, say, you know, we got a problem here. And so they institute and create the Defense Race Relations Institute. They create the equal opportunities places and actually people that ensure equal opportunity in the military. And Senator Tuberville is the one that said, listen, we're not an equal opportunity military. Well, that's against the law to do that. And so we create this equal opportunity structure. And guess what? It works. By the time we go to the Gulf War, we have 7% African-American officers and 31% senior African-American leaders just in the Army. And the reason that we are successful is we're able to address those issues. And by the time we get to right now, listen, we need to make sure we have a diverse force. Otherwise, this volunteer military does not work. But the idea that we're woke, if I even knew what that meant, I would be able to refute it. But it just seems to be things that that people don't like.
Yeah,
we have the greatest military in the world.
I would just add that when the Supreme Court took up affirmative action 20 years ago, the most important briefs filed came from West Point and Annapolis because exactly what you just said, not only had they done it, but it worked. They were both better academies than they had been 30 years ago. They were training better officers than they had been 30 years ago, except for you.
Yeah, so true.
No, it is. Let me ask one more and then turn it back to James. If Israel goes into Gaza, which they may have to do given the awful things that happen, describe what that might be like.
Oh, my gosh. You know, first of all, what happened is just the horror, the abomination of slaughtering children, civilians. My heart goes out to the Israeli people, and I am I stand with them. Having said that, going in, you may have seen the pictures of what Gaza looks like. It looks like a Stalingrad. They have just completely destroyed it. So all those places are just perfect places to put IEDs. Those are improvised explosive devices, to put booby traps. They know the terrain. The Hamas knows the terrain better. It's going to be awful. And what is the strategic goal? Remember, you can't overcome bad strategy with good tactics. So what's the strategy here? Well, do away with Hamas? How do you do that? I have no idea. So they're going to go into this. But then on the other hand, how do you not go in?
Right.
So they're in it is going to be a bloody, long mess. And I don't know how it's going to end, except it's going to be really, really horrible for everybody. And the second and third order effects, whether it's Iran, the other nations in the Middle East, our allies and us, are so unpredictable. Remember, war is the most dangerous, chaotic, unpredictable activity that humans undertake, and humans are the most chaotic, dangerous, and unpredictable animal on the planet. It's like nothing but independent variables. It is going to be horror.
Well, that's frightening. James?
Right. So, General, you're obviously a highly educated, knowledgeable soldier. You're also a highly knowledgeable historian, a military historian. When I look at what they pulled off, Hamas, right under the nose of the most sophisticated surveillance state in the history of the world, without electronic communications, how they supplied these people, the coordination, what it takes, a guy, you got to come out of the paraglider's got to come, the boat out of the Mediterranean's got it was a pretty sophisticated thing they pulled off, wasn't it?
Absolutely brilliant. I mean, a level of sophistication, of integration of air, sea, and ground assets, of both. It is amazing. And they did that against the most technologically advanced force around. And it just goes to show, I mean, there's a couple things to think about from a military perspective. There's no obstacle is worth a darn unless it's covered by direct fire. And what do I mean by that? If you have a fence and you can't cover it with some human that has direct fire, meaning whether it's tanks or machine gun, it isn't a great obstacle. And that's the problem that they had. The second problem they had is that you have an enemy that has to figure out other ways to fight. And guess what? They totally did. Human beings when they are put against a wall, are the most adaptive people. I don't care which human beings you're talking about, the most adaptive it comes. And boy, I tell you, you see that in just spades with the way that Hamas reacted and the way they planned this. It shocked me with their sophistication and with the effectiveness. Now, it also horrified me because of what they did. But what's terrible is, and I hate to say this, but there's a purpose for what they did. And so if you think about the strategic value of what they did, horrific, the slaughtering children, but Israel has to go in and go into this place, and now they're going to destroy it. But how does that help in the long run? Well, strategically, probably it's going to tear apart the Saudi-U.S. Israeli deal. Don't know how that's going to come forward. It's going to further inflame the Gulf states. So there's a strategic means for what Hamas did, and I don't know how Israel is going to deal with that.
So if you take the professors at Carlisle, at Normandy War College, will this kind of change the way that, because it seemed like it was going to go all technology all the time in warfare. Not the stuff that an individual soldier has now, she's got to be a Berkeley engineer to operate it. But does this kind of change some thinking that something this simple and this primitive can be this effective?
Well, we've learned this lesson over and over again. We learned it when we thought the airplane was going to end wars. It doesn't. We thought that the atom bomb would end wars. It doesn't. We thought that the tank, in the 1973 Arab-Israeli war, the Israelis said, all we need are tanks. And they were crushed by infantry together. And we thought, you know, that Israelis thought this technology was going to win. No technology defeats human ingenuity. It just will never happen. And I think we know that. We continue to try to make it so war is lethal to our enemies and not to us. But in the end, to hold ground takes an infantryman. And it can be supported by tanks and airplanes and everything else. But here's the thing. You know, you think about this again. And there's this old saying about that there's an Air Force general, an admiral, and an army guy. And the Air Force, U.S. Air Force, says to the admiral, hey, admiral, way to go. You control the seas. Nobody can affect the high seas. You control it. Way to go, Navy. Hey, thanks there, Air Force General. Hey, you know what, Air Force General? You control the skies. Nobody else can do that without the U.S. Air Force there. And they both turn to the Army and say, hey, what about you guys? Every time you go in, it's like so complicated. You never win. What's the deal? And the Army guy looks at him and says, well, you know, how many people live in the air? How many people live in the ocean? It turns out that there are 8 billion people, and trying to control people is the hardest thing you can possibly do.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, James, this has been one of our great guests. He is, you have laid bare the Tuberville outrage, the stupidity, and also given us, I'm afraid, a horrifying lesson on what might happen in Gaza. But you are one great guest, and I can't thank you enough, General.
We'll get to crank it out this afternoon, General, but, you know, if you want to get somebody to get a trained military historian that's, you know, done a 3,000 lesson plans, it can probably talk.
Well, yeah, I mean, as you know, and you both can too, you can just about wind me up and I go, but I got to tell you, it's affecting my friends, you know? It's affecting the people that I care about, and I just can't imagine what he thinks he is doing, nor why we can't. I think, honestly,
he's stupid.
I think he referring to Tuberville thinks. I don't know.
He arrived in Washington as a United States senator and did not know there were 3 branches of government.
I know.
That's
sophisticated. Learning shit. Y'all don't need that.
And he defeated a good friend of mine. Doug Jones is a great American.
Oh, yeah.
He is a very good friend of mine.
Yeah,
he is a great, great guy. I love that guy. And to think that the people of Alabama would choose, luckily he beat the other guy, Moore.
Roy Moore, yeah.
Did you know he was a West Pointer?
Moore?
Roy Moore
was?
Yeah.
Nobody brings that up.
No, I don't think so.
Well, there are a few bad West Pointers.
You know, we're playing Army in 2 weeks.
I know.
And so my daughter's pediatrician is a West Point graduate. And he said, well, tell your daddy that I'm not going to, this one game, I'm not going to be pulling fellow shoes. So I'm going to get him a pass, you know, to box and to see if the, tell him he ought to walk down to the West Point box and introduce himself to the AD and everything. But he's also a colonel in the reserves.
Hey, oh, Ty, yeah. I teach at Penn with David Eisenhower. We have lunch every week.
Oh, yeah.
And there are some West Point stories that he can tell.
Oh, he can. In fact, I am headed down. If you next time you tell him, please tell him that I am headed down to what is now Fort Gordon at the end of the month to the renaming ceremony to call it Fort Eisenhower.
Yes, that's great. That is so great. Listen, you've been great. We didn't want to keep you any longer.
You. No, I understand. Thank you so much.
James, you mentioned earlier, but I thought South Carolina Congresswoman Nancy Mace might just be one of those interesting members in a pretty sorry Republican House caucus. As you note, I'm always looking for that good Republican. The first woman graduate of the Citadel, and though a Trump supporter, she sharply criticized him after January 6, 2021. She was one of the eight who voted against Kevin McCarthy, dooming his speakership. I really didn't have a dog in that fight, but she charged he lied to her about her efforts to help women and address sexual assaults. So what does she do the next day? She announces she's supporting for Speaker House Judiciary Committee Chair Ohio Rep. Jim Jordan for Speaker. Margaret Brennan of CBS asked Mace whether her concerns about sexual assaults applied to Jim Jordan, the former assistant wrestling coach at Ohio State, where seven wrestlers have said he knew about the doctor who was sexually assaulting athletes, and he covered it up. Jordan denies it, but there is no reason for those wrestlers to fabricate a story about a powerful politician. Mace feigned ignorance, says she wasn't versed on that one, while noting, well, he wasn't indicted, was he? Congresswoman, an honorable Citadel graduate, if you're going to vote for someone for speaker after accusing the previous one of stiffing you on women's issues and sexual assault, maybe you ought to check his record first. Put her back with a sorry caucus, James.
I mean, you know, I think she tried to be sane and the voters wouldn't let her be sane, but maybe I'm being a little too generous with her. I don't know, by the way, just on the whole Jim Jordan thing, there's that George Clooney movie that is made, and we're just waiting for it to be released. And it's going to be pretty damning. It's going to be very damning.
Well, there's just, you know, we've talked about this before, but having been on a wrestling team in high school, but a big wrestling team, and I had, you know, a lot of people, it's unimaginable that the trainer or the doctor could be sexually assaulting in the shower and elsewhere multiple wrestlers. I mean, a big
it couldn't happen on a football team much as a wrestling team.
Yeah, and the assistant coach didn't know about it. That's just strange credulity. They tried to get the Republican Ohio legislature to extend the time of which you could bring action against that, and of course, guess what? They said no.
Apparently, he was knew about it. According to some of the wrestlers, he was actively trying to suppress it. And I think that's in the Clooney movie. But what I don't get, and it'll go into my, how they just go out in public, like just nothing happened. Wouldn't you be embarrassed? I mean, I don't know. But what they do, they don't care. And this is the one thing that I get more than any other comments when I'm out traveling. James, why don't we be tough like them and, you know, do like they do? And the complicated answer, we can't. Because if we did, we would be embarrassed. Let's take the $6 billion Biden taxpayer gift to Iran. Okay, none of that's not remotely true. does that even stop them from 1 second from saying it? No. They don't give a shit. And the people who receive the information, not only do they not give a shit, they like it. The more they lied to, the more they like it. So every fact checker comes up and points out this was something Trump, the exemption the Trump administration gave him, kept in a South Korean bank, and it never gets said, blah, blah, blah. It does not matter. It doesn't matter. They just keep plowing away. And just like 60% of the people in the country think that Joe Biden did something wrong in the Hunter Biden affair. Well, there's no evidence of it. But what they find out is they just keep repeating it. And you keep calling them out, and they keep repeating it. It's just, it's amazing.
Absolutely. But they are what they are.
And then it's not going to change. And the people want to be lied to, and they know they have to lie to them to get power, and they're doing it. And we can't do it. We just can't.
All right, and now for those questions from our very smart listeners. James, we've discussed this, but David in Livingston, New Jersey, says it's not the age, it's the lack of fight. So how can we get over the frustration and despair that the president does not present the toughness to campaign an attack? I feel like we're reliving the Dukakis campaign and I'm going to lose a winnable election.
Well, I think the two are related. I think that in fairness to Joe Biden, he's been a fight. I mean, he's been resilient and fought all his life. And I think he's, you know, doing a terrific job in managing multiple crises. But you're right, he is old. And, you know, when he walks, you can see it, and it does slow you down. It's inarguable. This is true.
Yeah, I wish it weren't, but it is. It is totally inarguable. Mm-hmm. James, I'm going to take a question from New Orleans. This is from Red, who writes us often and always has good questions. Red says, with RFK Jr. announcing an independent run and the Republicans now disseminating material against him, what do you think his effect on the race will be? Is there any state you'd expect him to have an effect on the Electoral College? Red, an effect on the Electoral College, yes. I mean, he gets 2 or 3%. He can affect the Electoral College as candidates have before in 16 and in 2000. I think this is a really sad story. He's made a fool of himself. He has tarnished a great family name. The person that I think first fascinated me in politics, I fell in love with Jack Kennedy when I was in college, but Bobby Kennedy I thought was the real deal, and I even at one point considered leaving the news business and seeing if I can get a low-level job with him. And I think what RFK Jr. has done with his absurd campaign has just, as I say, tarnished that name. Who does he take from if he gets 2, 3, 4%? I'm not sure. The RNC wouldn't be disseminating materials against him if they were confident it would only hurt Biden. He has a Democratic name and he has a right-wing platform. So you tell me, James.
Well, first of all, Sean Hannity went after him on his program. I guess it was night before last. Hard. Hard. So I think I said this last week, and I might say it every week between now and the election. In the states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, all right, and Arizona, Trump got a higher percent in 2020 than he did in 2016. Now, mull on that. In those four critical states, Trump had a higher percent in 2020, an election he lost, and lost each one of those states, than he did in 2016, an election that he won, and he won each of those states. So that's the Jill Stein effect. I mean, I don't know where these people are coming from, because you're going to have no labels out there. That's almost a certainty. And Bobby Kennedy is going to run. He writes crazy. They'll attack him from everywhere. I don't know. Cornel West is going to get votes. And a good part of the votes that he gets would go to Biden. I'm telling you. It does not take much to upset. And the presidential head-to-heads, I know they're pretty useless in October before the election year, but none of them indicated much margin for error, if you ask me.
The only ray of hope is that they watch a lot of film of Harry Truman in 1948, because he faced a pincher. But I'm not. I share your concern, your pessimism, Simon.
But if Tom Dury would have been president, it would have been the end of the country.
That's true. And if Mitt Romney or John McCain or Bob Dole had been president, it wouldn't have been the end of the country. Donald Trump becomes president, it is the end of the America as we know it. That is not an exaggeration. Simon.
The second Bush put us pretty close.
Well, I'll still take that over. Donald Trump coming back. Simon in Cincinnati says, assuming democracy is at stake in 24, isn't it incumbent for a Democrat to primary Biden and campaign without criticizing but highlighting the threats of MAGA while thanking Biden and stating it's time for the next generation of Democrats to continue the fight? Pretty good question, James.
Look, I think I agree with the premise. But yes, the country wants, to a large extent, the country is just screaming for new leadership and some generational change. It's evident. And if you don't give them that choice, I don't know what the future results are going to be. But it's going to be people feel like that their voice doesn't count. They got enthusiastic about the country. They don't feel good about voting. The ramifications of it are just not good at all.
Totally agree, and I think we have the general with us. Andrew in Los Angeles, this is really an interesting proposition. Andrew asks, is there any value in Hakeem Jeffries and the House leadership's nominating Liz Cheney as McCarthy's replacement? You get enough moderate center-left Democrats and sane Republicans could get them to a winning number. Am I crazy? Andrew, it's a great idea. It's not going to happen because the crazy left and the crazy right would block it. But it would drive the Jordans and the Elise Stefanik crazy. I think if they could pull it off, she would do it. I think Hakeem Jeffries, who, by the way, has been a great leader, would do it. But I'm afraid that the moderate Republicans just are timid. And the left-wing Democrats just wouldn't go along. James?
Yeah, I agree. It's a provocative question. And if the left-wing Democrats had any sense of humor or mischief about them, they would go along with it too. But I got to ask you, I don't know how they get from here to there with Scalise and Jim Jordan and McCarthy in the background, and it took them 15 votes to get there with one candidate.
As of today, they ain't going to get any help from the Democrats, nor should they, after the way they behaved. James, you're going to have to take this one, and we'll tell you why in a minute. Tyler in Donelson, Tennessee. Now listen to this. This is good. Will Brandon leave Reeves all shook up, or will he check into the Heartbreak Hotel come November? Talking about the Mississippi governor's race, the Democratic candidate is Elvis's second cousin. My son's working for him, so I'm not going to comment on that. But I love the way he put the question, James.
So there's an opinion piece in The Hill today. It says Brandon's leaving them all shook up. So, and I've heard it of a woman. Embarrassed, can't put the name up, but it's kind of worth reading. It's so hard because when I tell people that we got a real shot in Mississippi, they just kind of glaze over you. I think we're going to win Kentucky. And by the way, I think Andrew Beshear is the most underrated or underappreciated politician in the United States. He's just very hard to be seen when you're in Kentucky. But he is that good, And I suspect that after he's reelected, we might hear a little bit more from him nationally. The other two races, Mississippi and Louisiana, and the other big one, the just as big as these governor's races, these Virginia legislative races. They're huge. I think that Brandon's got no worse than a 45% chance to win the thing. I don't know why I say if I don't have it, but by anything that we know, the polling is very tight. The third party has said she endorsed Brandon. I don't know how much good it's going to do, but it can't hurt anything. And the most important thing is that the data show that the blacks are sick of Tate Reeves' bullshit of no water and trying to take political power away and all these kind of goofy political games they're playing Jackson. So I think we got a real shot here. I'll be honest with you. But we'll see. It's a big election. You know, and out of if elections have consequences, it's 500,000 people that will have health insurance if Brendan is elected that don't, well, if he's not. They will not. If he's
Danielle in Westchester, New York, says she just donated $50 to Adam Frisch after his he was on our show. And she says she makes as many similar donations as she can afford, but she's wondering whether the size of donations actually matter, or would it be better off giving time, et cetera. You know, Danielle, I'm just a simple newspaper guy. I don't have the wisdom of James Carville in this, but I would think the answer is both. Give what you can give and work as hard as you can. And you're in Westchester. I forget if there's one of those Republican congressmen who pulled an upset in 2022, but it's not that long a drive to Long Island, and you got two or three races out there. So, you know, if you can give $50, great, but also give your time.
You know, I go back to the interview we had with Adam Frisch, and I got to admit that I was kind of skeptical. I think the Afton guys, it'd be for him, obviously. It'd be for him, anybody against Lauren Boebert. I walked away highly impressed.
Yeah, I did too.
I would have been for him no matter what. He could have been an orangutan, and I'd be for him. But I found him to be highly humble and highly impressive man. And I think that, you know, that $50 is $50 well spent. It's something in that volunteers that I've noticed happens is a lot of people, particularly older people, they can't travel to Wisconsin or wherever, you know, even these Virginia special elections. But I tell you, if you call the state party or you look at somebody doing that, ask them for a list of names.
To call.
I'll write postcards to. Here's some names and addresses, and this is a Democratic voter file of a voter that's high probability. They have to grade all these voters on the files, and you can write, you know, people that you think might be in the middle, or you can write low turnout propensity people, but, you know, asking to turn out. I think these postcards are a really effective way to volunteer for a race, and you don't have to leave and your house and do something. And I do think that someone getting a postcard from another human being saying, hi, you know, this is Melissa in Bethesda and just wanted to, you know, drop you a line, urge you to vote Democratic, our freedom's on
the line. Okay, Danielle, you got your marching orders. The final question comes from Kristen in Jacksonville, Florida, who says DeSantis had a weak opponent in 2020. I don't think he's as popular, Danielle, or Kristen says, as it seems. But I also struggle with who's worse, Ron or Don? James is contemplating.
Who's worse,
Ron or Don?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is different degrees of horribleness. But, I mean, you can't – I don't know that DeSantis is a criminal. To the extent that a person can know this without an actual conviction, I think that Donald Trump is clearly a career criminal.
He's been convicted of rape.
I don't know. DeSantis, first of all, his numbers are now underwater in Florida. People have to understand this, right? And he made a big bet when his campaign came out, and it was all going to be on woke. It's woke Disney, woke schools, woke bathrooms, all right? And this is Florida's way. Woke goes to die. He started that, he was at 32. Starting the last debate, he was at 12. You know the one word that never came out of Ron DeSantis' mouth? Woke. And he made a horrible strategic decision in which my friend in Jacksonville knows, and other people, other Floridians and all people along the Atlantic coast and the Gulf of Mexico know, these homeowner insurance rates are just smothering people. And the Republicans control the insurance commissioner, they control the governor, the House, the Senate, the courts, the you name it. And someone sent me a chart on how these home insurance rates have exploded. And it's almost unbelievable. And you think about this, though. It's not a discretionary expense. If the gas prices go too high, you can say, well, we'll drive less. If you don't have the homeowner's insurance, the mortgage will foreclose on you. You signed a contract that you will keep for the length of your mortgage, you would keep homeowner's insurance. And so these people are getting slaughtered in Florida. And DeSantis is off mumbling about was, he doesn't anymore, woke something. If you don't have a name, if you can't, I had a guy taught me in law school. It was like an adjunct. And he said, if you can't think of a citation, just say it's Hornbook law. Okay? if the Republican can't think of what to say, just say woke three times. That's the answer.
Kristen, I think it's there is no easy choice here. It's between bad and really bad, and you can pick it. Okay. But thank you for the question. Right. Thank all of you for the questions. Right. We didn't get to them this week. We'll get to them next week. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Now, following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Lomi, ZBiotics, and Miracle Made, in the show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You also can find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon for your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. Now we're going to be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.